All lines are now bridged.
All right. Welcome and thank you for joining the Public Health Data Systems Task Force. I'm Mike Berry with ONC, and I would like to thank our co-chairs and the entire task force for their hard work. We really appreciate everyone's participation today. And just a reminder that we welcome public comments, whether through the public comment period held towards the end of each meeting or through the public chat feature. And you're also welcome to submit written comments to onc-hitech@slsolutionsllc.com. All public comments are included in the meeting minutes, and all meeting materials can be found on healthit.gov. So let's get started with roll call. When I call your name, please indicate your presence, and I'll begin with our co-chairs. Carolyn Peterson.
Good morning.
Janet Hamilton.
Good morning.
Danielle Brooks.
Good morning.
Denise Chrysler.
Good morning, I'm here.
Jim Daniel.
Good morning, I'm here.
Dee Leitner.
Good morning.
Ngozi Azike. Claudia Grossman. Steve Henricks.
Good morning, I'm here.
Jim Georges. John Kansky.
I'm here.
Bryant Karras. Stephen Lane.
Good morning.
Dale Lapris.
Good morning.
Les Leonard.
Present.
Denise Love. Arian Malik.
Good morning.
Glenn McDonald. Aaron Neary.
Good morning.
Larry Mole.
Good morning, sir.
Abby Sears.
Good morning.
And Cheryl Turney.
Good morning.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you. And I'd like to now turn it over to our co-chairs, Carolyn and Janet, for their opening remarks. Janet, Carolyn.
Good morning, everyone. It's great to see everyone back for another meeting of our task force today. As you know, we have quite a lot to cover and in a short time. We hope to work today very effectively by reviewing on slides some of the feedback that we have received from you in the homework so far, and then to pull up the crosswalk and start talking about how that feedback translates into recommendations that we might make to ONC as our final work product for this task force. I appreciate all the feedback that we've received so far, and I want to let you know that because we're adding volume with that, in the coming weeks, we will be sending out Excel spreadsheets that include all of that feedback that you can use as you review the recommendations and think about how you might want to change them or what might need to be added or revised, just to give you a heads up. So if you have not yet had a chance to log into the spreadsheets and submit your information, please go ahead and do that this week to get us caught up and so that we can really operate from a comprehensive information and knowledge base. Can we go for the next slides, please? We will start by reviewing our charge, and then Janet will share some remarks and lead us through the preliminary feedback. If we could have the next slide, please. So again, here is our charge. I'll read it for the benefit of our members who are just on the telephone and for the public. The task force is here to inform HHS's response to President Biden's executive order on ensuring a data-driven response to COVID-19 and future high-consequence public health threats. The task force has two priorities. First, to identify and prioritize policy and technical gaps associated with the effectiveness, interoperability, and connectivity of information systems relevant to public health. This would include a focus on surveillance systems, infrastructure improvements, health equity, clinical engagement, research and innovation, and educating and empowering individuals. And also, the task force shall identify characteristics of an optimal future state for information systems relevant to public health and their. And next slide, please. Now I'll pass the mic to Janet for her opening remarks, and we'll get into the feedback. Thank you.
Great. Thank you so much, Carolyn. And I'll just comment that I am not seeing text displayed on my slides, so I hope others are able to see that. I will just echo for opening remarks that we do have a lot to get through in a short amount of time, and I think we have appreciated all of the feedback that we have gotten thus far. And in an effort to be more efficient, we are going to be structuring this to review slides with some of the feedback that we have gotten thus far and summarizing that. And then from there, moving in to the new discussion topics, which today will be focused on lab. So I'm still not seeing the slides, but I do have them pulled up in a separate space. So please I will be navigating these, but hope we can stay on the same page together. So I am looking at slide 7 now. And this slide is related to discussion that we had previously around key surveillance use cases and identifying what major gaps exist in health standards that prevent data from flowing between clinical and public health entities. I think one of the challenges that we did have as a group was really trying to be broad and deep at the same time. So these surveillance use cases are 4 large surveillance use cases around testing, case reporting, syndromic surveillance, and immunization. And I think what we have are broad comments, and we hope to spend a little bit more time, as I mentioned at the outset, getting a little deeper in this space. And so today we will be focusing in more on the laboratory piece. But these are the things that were identified during our previous meeting. So lack of adherence to standards that are existing. We have seen a lower uptake of some of the newer standards, so those like electronic case reporting, as well as a lack of certification requirements within EHRs. There is confusion over different reporting standards across jurisdiction about knowing what to report, when to report, and how to report. When reports are made, there is often missing data in those reports, and that is a result of multiple causes, including that standards really do not address completeness or timeliness. There are duplicative and misaligned reporting requests, which can add to provider administrative burden, and I think also ties into the bullet around confusion. And then I think another thing that was very clearly brought out was lack of incentives to really move adoption forward in a meaningful way. Next slide, slide 8, please. So here we're looking at real and perceived barriers that continue to inhibit progress. Integrating multiple public health social services and clinical data sources when responding to public health emergencies. And those things that were identified both in the meeting as well as in the homework were a lack of patient identifiers and ability to link patients across clinical settings and public health. And I think specifically there is no single patient identification number. And then when we do get reports, there are often missing patient identifiers. Current processes to set up data exchanges are time consuming, for both providers as well as public health to test these new interfaces, and that onboarding ramp takes time and resources and needs simplification. Lack of centralized national infrastructure can also lead to duplicative and confusing reporting data flows and requests. So not only have there been data requests by state and locals, but also in this response, data requests at the federal level, which has led to additional confusion. Lack of clarity on how to best protect patient privacy while promoting interoperability. We heard very strongly this issue around lack of consistent funding for public health infrastructure, and that previous funding models have been rigid, often disease-specific, and cause multiple problems, including data silos and lack of interoperability. There's provider and administrative overload, perceived lack of value in data and reporting, lack of consistent HIEs and capabilities within those HIEs to support public health reporting, lack of standards describing SOTA and where SOTA data could be collected, and of course, differences in social service and data systems creating difficulty in connecting public health and the clinical. Okay, so I'm still without slides in my presenter view, so I'm going to move on to slide 9. And this is feedback on what real and perceived barriers exist to continue to inhibit progress in integrating multiple public health, social service, and clinical data sources when responding to public health emergencies. Same topic. This is addressing now from a policy and licensing and legal perspective. So we have seen, and I think the comment was brought out very strongly, that there's a lack of recognition that public health is part of healthcare. We have often viewed these separately, and that has led to many of the challenges that we have today. A lack of alignment in jurisdiction versus state versus federal privacy and security laws, lack of clarity with HIPAA on data sharing for public health purposes. For example, minimum necessary can often lead to differing interpretations, and those occur at the state and local levels. Again, lack of adoption of incentives for public health data sharing, and specifically public health data sharing across states as well. Again, we're seeing the lack of funding for public health overall. And then there are instances where we also see lack of federal guidance and restrictive laws on data sharing at the state level that often prevent certain types of data sharing and prevent data sharing between states and the federal level. We also see brought out from a patient privacy and digital access as well as a social justice standpoint, again, issues around HIPAA with the current use cases, challenges with FQHCs and individual providers often lacking resources to establish the key public health connections, and then a lack of transparency about how to protect health information, geolocation, and how that's collected, used, and stored. And then to summarize for slide 10, what real or perceived barriers exist as it pertains to this same topic, public health, social services, and clinical data sources when responding to public health emergencies, but specifically addressing gaps and barriers on federal versus state and local sharing. So again, brought up strongly, variability in local jurisdiction and state reporting requirements and capabilities. We don't have the same sets of capabilities across the country. Lack of agreement on a minimum necessary data set that would meet both state and federal surveillance goals, lack of standardized patient identifiers and the inability to leverage federal funding of social service programs to adopt standards and technology compatible with public health. I realize I'm moving through these pretty quickly, but we have a lot to get through today. So slide 11 focuses on issues around health equity and surveillance systems. The question that was posed to the group for discussion, as well as included in the homework for feedback, would be, how do we ensure that surveillance systems adequately identify potential sources of bias and health equity to address, and health inequity to address issues around health equity? And there were several gaps that were identified here. Again, lack of adequate standards that address the collection of this, as well as we see gaps that don't require certain kinds of data to be collected as well. So gaps in things like disability information, race and ethnicity. There are often outdated or ineffective processes for collecting this data. I think we can recognize that there have been for many years established 5 different race categories and 2 different ethnicities, but that doesn't necessarily represent how people identify themselves in these categories, which can lead to challenges in actually collecting the information at all. And then really, again, lack of funding coming out very strongly for underserved areas and the inability to consistently include those with poor access in healthcare and surveillance activities. In terms of gaps identified for streamlining data sharing, asking the question about what, if any, work would be needed to ensure accommodation of individuals' desire for and right of access to protected health information. We identified as a group lack of privacy regulations that promote data sharing between social service and public health, and that in the absence of regulations that promote this data sharing between public health and social services, we really need to ensure that there is consistent electronic pathways that allow that data sharing to occur. Specifically related to GIS data and different types of patient or population movement data, there is a lack of public health actually being able to tap into that to determine where service gaps may exist and use of GIS data. And then a lack of standards, again, to link public health data to social service data. And finally, around case reporting, and I will highlight that we did not specifically address this question during the discussion the last time, but it did come out in several of the other questions. And then we did get some feedback from the homework. So just want to be sure that we recognize that this did not fully get discussed the last time. It's specific to case reporting. The question was, how can we reduce the manual public health reporting burdens for providers across the care continuum and support services? Are there steps and incentives that are needing to scale automated methods of case reporting, for example, electronic case reporting? And in 3 bucket areas, the first being hospital or provider networks, and as identified, one of the activities was to promote EHR vendor adoption of standards that do promote interoperability for long-term care and support services. It was identified that there needed to be improved funding for EHR adoption in long-term care and support services, and that case reporting was an activity, as well as to include incentives for adoption of other related standards, such as electronic laboratory reporting, syndromic surveillance and immunization registries, and then for community providers, the need to include incentives and funding for standards adoption there. Okay, so I am going to stop here because I think that reflects the discussion that we had previously and see if we have comments here. And then we can go on after we have some opportunity for comments and discussion into the laboratory reporting and lab issues, which we want to really focus on today.
Janet, this is Brian.
Yes.
Tremendous apologies. I hope you'll forgive me. In 5 minutes, I have to drop to do a talk at the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. So I've got some prepared comments that I'll send you via email.
Okay, that's great. And if others
related
written,
to the ELR, related to the ELR and challenges that we face.
You can post those in the chat, Bryant, also, and then everyone will have the benefit of them now.
Great. Thank you.
So I see that Clem's hand is raised in the Connect, so why don't we start with Clem, and then we'll have comments from Jim Georges. Go ahead, Clem. You might be muted, Clem.
Oh, no, I was muted. Okay. Yeah, I've got a number of thoughts. One is I think we got too many things and it's too diffuse. I think we got to focus down a little bit, and some of it's redundant, repetitive. We won't make an impact. In terms of the patient identifiers, we're screwed. You know, there's a federal law against it. But there's a couple of surrogates. Medicare now has a unique identifier for all of its aged patients. So we could at least take advantage of that and maybe take advantage of it won't work as well as the other insurance IDs. That's just a thought. The issue about sending patient complete patient information in the laboratory has got some problems. I think some of it's related to privacy, you know, where they just send the accession number off to some distant lab, and whether that's because they can't carry the information, but that needs to be investigated as the why and whether there's some deep problems and why they don't send along the patient registration record when they make the request to referral labs. The stack of lack of standards, I think, is not fair. I think mostly it's lack of use of them or lack of understanding of them. I mean, the standards messages about lab tests could be sent anywhere. It's just a matter they may not have receivers. I think public health, many of the smaller public health departments don't have the resources to accept electronic things. So that's got to be a priority in somewhat. And then the third thing is that public health and clinical care don't understand each other. So what happens, the burden on physicians comes directly because public health is asking a lot of questions the physician maybe can't answer well, or if they're asked differently, they could have sent some, or there's a surrogate, they could have sent a surrogate and would have handled just as well. Finally, they shouldn't ask physicians' offices ever to report stuff that the referral labs or the commercial labs know and would have sent already. So I think there just should be more dialogue between the two sides to understand the issues and not just be demanding and say, you got to do this without thought about what else, how else you might do it. That's all I got.
Thanks, Clem. Let's go to Jim Georges.
Wonderful summary. I agree with I would agree with the different points, but I wanted to make sure that some of the things we had talked about in the past and that I and maybe others had submitted in the survey made it in, and here they are. There's three or four. The first is, I don't know if we call out more the costs and of this point-to-point interface approach, or even if people, you know, adhere to standards, et cetera, the contracting, the testing of interfaces, the maintaining of them. I hope we can call out more that under unifying infrastructure for this and the others to simplify for the different stakeholders so that we're not landing in a world of everyone doing point-to-point. The second is, just calling out, I think you have lack of adherence to standards, just wanted to emphasize that. But coupled with that, it's not just about adhering to standards. It's the tremendous variation in the implementation of those standards and interfaces that leads to all kinds of costs. So I think, you know, calling out implementation guides, et cetera, is important. And then the last is for this and the other categories is aligning. I think you have incentives in there, but making sure that the incentives include all the important stakeholders, not just one or two, not just providers, but also public health, PPE suppliers, lab, et cetera. So people being incentivized to use standards and have implementation guides and processes, and then hopefully all of that being done in a way that avoids a gazillion point-to-point interfaces that are highly costly to all involved.
Thanks, Jim. Let's go to Denise Love. Denise, you might be on mute. Okay, it seems like we're having some audio difficulties with Denise's line. Let's go to Steve Eichner.
Thank you so much. A couple of points. One, I think one of the things we need to consider is how information is being routed to public health and thinking about some of our data quality issues like race and ethnicity or other missing data. It's really not of a business interest for some laboratories to have information about whether I went to Aruba for travel last month or not. If we can simplify or change the routing so that the ask and order entry questions and similar data is collected after the laboratory result is provided, we might be more efficient and reduce laboratories having to invest additional resources to store information that they're really not doing anything with other than storing it and forward to other destinations. In looking at the rules of HIEs and costs of onboarding and exchange, I think it's important to understand that there are two different components of that cost. One, looking at establishing a basic connection, whether it's VPN or SFTP or a web service or whatever on that level, we spend much more of our time spending our efforts on ensuring that the quality and the content of the message coming across that connection is meeting public health's quality standards. So I just wanted to tag that out, that that's a burden that still exists regardless of the number of connections any provider may have or may need to maintain. And just pulling that apart, I think, becomes relevant as we look at really the costs of connectivity and where can we pick up efficiencies in connection and what are our true costs in validating or establishing those connections. Additionally, looking at health equity, I think it's important that we address race and ethnicity issues. We also need to make sure that we're addressing disabled and other types of equity issues across the board. You know, right now, if there's a disability question asked, it's usually, oh, are you disabled, without any subsequent information, and that really doesn't get to the heart of the issue or really help address some of the gaps that folks have. So I think we've got a lot of opportunity, and the summary comments are really good in addressing a lot of them. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Steve. And I just want to clarify that we will be moving into some new material today, so we're going to take a couple more comments and then go forward. Let's go to Arian Malik.
This summary is absolutely fantastic. One additional point, or maybe elaboration of a point, is that public health data systems are going to be best run when they build on top of a broader interoperability infrastructure. So historically, public health has, in the worst case, adopted very specific or bespoke interfaces. The classic example of this is the reportable conditions specified CDAs that called for, you know, very specific information for reportable conditions, but wasn't flexible in the field. The new approaches, particularly ECR and ECR Now, that build on top of HL7 FHIR and are trigger-based, are much better approaches because they build on top of a broader infrastructure interoperability evolution. So to the extent that we can have interoperability evolution that benefits the whole health system and benefits public health, public health is going to be better off. You know, another example of this is that I don't know that anybody would have connected improving the orders results interface for clinicians with public health. But if you look at where the breakdowns were in ELR, it was by and large labs that had no access to demographic and contact information. If we start thinking again about these flows as a system and build benefit for all the actors, in this case building benefit for clinicians doing orders electronically in a bidirectional way that's standards-based, we can build on top of that infrastructure for building better public health. So it's an interoperability flavor of the basic point that public health is healthcare, and it's healthcare of populations in the broadest sense. We should also think about the public health data infrastructures as being interoperability and built on top of the interoperability we're also using to improve individual care episodes. Thank you.
Thanks, Arian. We continue to have trouble with Denise's audio, so I think at this point we're going to move forward with a new discussion. Janet will pick that up. I see that there are some other hands raised, but I think in the interest of being able to get to our new material today, we will hold the discussion for now. Thanks.
Great. Thanks so much, Carolyn. So again, we wanted to focus our new discussion today on lab, and I fully recognize that even in reflecting on the overview of what we've heard, that we have already heard comments specific to some of the issues that are raised and specific to lab. I think the way that we will take this is to go question by question. And so we may need to truncate some of the conversation in order to get to the questions themselves. And again, recognizing some issues that are on these slides that were brought up, have already been brought up in the conversation, and we appreciate folks who submitted their thoughts in this during the homework. So looking forward to refining these, and I think, maybe getting towards Clem's comment that we were a little broad before, and so now we're going to focus down in. So specifically, two labs. The question up for discussion is during COVID-19, what were common themes encountered that impacted the timing and completeness of COVID-19 result data reported to state and local health departments? And issues that have been identified and for discussion and refinement include missing demographic data, incomplete information, or not collected at all, leading to incomplete data when reporting to public health, inconsistent capture of residency information, particularly those with housing instability, delays in test turnaround time to inform patients and patient result information, as well as delaying the data getting to public health. COVID-19 test orders required many data points to be entered, often manually, by ordering providers, which led to some increased burden. And as we just heard Aaron make in some of the comments, that the order interfaces were not set up to easily pass info between the EHR and the lab order system. Lack of HL7 and standards adoptions amongst labs. There were many new laboratories that came on. Many of them had never reported before to public health and were not familiar with the HL7 standards. Lack of incentives to support reporting at all, to support as reporting timeliness. So even if there was a standard, no incentives that indicated how quickly reports should be made or how complete the data should be when reports are made. Again, barriers in matching records from case reports and laboratory results, many new providers, different non-traditional testing locations, And patient forms requested to be filled out at the time of testing were often missing key demographic fields, not allowing the patient to ever complete them themselves or the provider. And then a lack of patient opportunity or engagement to provide the demographic information at a later date, for example, when retrieving their test results, et cetera. So I will stop here with this information and look forward to the discussion.
Task force members, if you could please raise your hand using the Adobe Connect tool. We will get on to the laboratories and ELR discussion. Abby Sears, let's go ahead, please.
Thank you. One of the things, I think this is a great list. I'm just going to bring an example of what we struggle with our patient population. We have a higher rate of testing positive and or needing to move data for contact tracing. And our patient population has the highest rate of erroring out based off of patient matching. So we have very complete data, but we can't get it matched effectively. And I know that we're already discussing the importance of finding an algorithm, but I just want to reiterate from an equity issue the importance of that in the process and then reinforce using national frameworks because it's really incredibly important that those standards are being supported and shared.
Thanks, Danielle. I'm sorry. Thanks, Abby. If we could go to Danielle Brooks, please.
Yeah, I was on your mind. No worries. I'd raised my hand. I agree with the previous comments in terms of just making sure that that is kind of considering the equity issue. One of the things I've noticed, though, missing from the broader conversation, I'm not quite sure if this is the right place, but the consistency of capturing language data. And so while we have talked a lot about demographic data, particularly race, ethnicity, language has been left out. And why that is important as we look at this communication information, patient privacy, that kind of information, and also understanding those key pieces about language need and language access that actually helps facilitate public health messaging and downstream impacts of making sure that we're actually getting to the people in a manner that they understand it the most. So I would encourage us to also think beyond the demographic component and also think about that communication aspect because it's such a tie-in to making sure that individuals can properly consent and also things are expressed to them in the best direction. Thank you.
Thanks, Abby. Let's go to Stephen Hinrich.
I want to affirm all the items that are on the list, but also call attention to the importance of unique identifiers. And that is critical when we begin to look at the over 750 million COVID test results that went through our systems and the need to deduplicate. And if we don't have a unique identifier, at least at the state level, it will be very difficult to make sense of all the results, many of which have been duplicated by repeat testing. Thank you.
Thanks, Stephen. I see Denise Love has gotten her audio system working now with connection. Denise, please go ahead.
Well, I this may be derailed this conversation, but I'm trying to figure out where the pain points are and where the best places to capture the non-clinical data more upstream rather than, you know, every lab test and every visit, because I just see a lot of pain points and not clear how that would work. So that may derail the conversation, but I just wanted to register my confusion.
Hey, thanks. And Clem, I see your hand is up. Go ahead,
yep,
on laboratories and ELR.
Yes, thank you. Well, I think we got to separate the issues that are technical and solvable by technical means and those that are not. You know, again, the lack of an identifier, we can't change that yet. We should lobby, you know, maybe we could. and there is some slight movement toward it. The issue about capturing demographic data goes way deeper than standards. It's that people won't say it. Either both the clerks won't pick it up or the people who are coming to the front door won't pick it up, or they don't, because they're from other country, they don't understand what the different racial categories mean. So I don't know how we can solve that. They're in the standards. They've always been in the standards. And at our hospital, when I was working in the inner city, we had about 30% of the racial data was missing consistently. So it's not a technical problem. But it's important. I mean, I just don't know how we're going to solve it. That's all. Thanks.
You know, Clem, this might be an area for others to comment on and drill down into more, but I think one issue, and this is Janet again for folks who are only on the phone, is that it doesn't get asked. But I think we also really identified in the pandemic that even if it's asked at one point in the process, so for example, in the patient encounter, the order process is not moving that data over. So when an order is placed through an electronic order interface, even if the data was captured within the electronic health record, it's not being moved over into the order. And so then when the lab result is received by public health, the data was missing because it was never received by the laboratory.
Well, that's a deep problem. We should investigate it a lot. Because mm-hmm. the V2 spec says the registration record goes with the order. Mm-hmm. So why that's not happening and whether it gets dropped some along, I still worry that some people feel that it's privacy information, they can't take it mm-hmm. in the order. We need to understand why it's not happening, because it's a standard part of the V2 spec.
And then let's go to Daniel Brooks, please.
Sure. I want to address Clem's comment. So I think that, and I saw some kind of in the chat, it's not necessarily a understanding issue on the consumer side per se. The way that the processes and the best practices have been set up, they're inconsistent across not only markets, but within health systems themselves. There have been practices where individuals are allowed to estimate person's race or ethnicity is based on anything from a last name to an appearance. And so part of the reason why this demographic data is so incomplete is because, one, the standards are not there. Two, it's not also an issue of a privacy concern per se. It just takes a little bit additional information to explain the rationale and also a way of reordering the questions. So, for example, we know from a pretty much factual matter, if you ask somebody their ethnicity, you will be able to ascertain those demographic fields a lot better than just going to a standard OMB category. So I'd actually argue the rationale why demographic data is so difficult, or I wouldn't even say difficult to collect, incomplete, is one, there's no standardized way of doing it. Two, the current categories are insufficient. And three, we need to make sure that's an operational, as well as making sure we're informing the consumer as to why. And so I would really kind of challenge our thinking around that, because I think it is, again, coming back to really making sure we're creating that standardized process, because I think it's more incumbent upon our work to make sure that that is consistent and learning from those past mistakes, but realizing that there is a very strong and very accurate way of moving forward.
Thanks, Danielle. And I see Jim Durgis has his hand up.
Yeah, hey, thank you so much. I appreciate I wanted to piggyback off, I think it was Arian's comments about having a platform, you know, that public health departments, et cetera, need to be built on an existing framework. And I just want to give you our experience. You know, we had to actually create a position called the COVID Information Data Czar. And the reason we had to do that at every facility is because we were responsible for reporting on every single patient and their status, were they tested, were they not, et cetera. Is it pending? Did the result come back? And the reality is patients would come to our hospitals, either be directly admitted, come through the ER, and if we tested them, it was one issue, dealing with the labs that give us results back and not adhering to standards, where we had to actually map all that to value sets before we could actually report. But I'm talking about even upstream from that. We had patients come in who may have been tested in an outpatient clinic. Maybe they were tested in another hospital. Maybe they went to public health. And we had to have this information person, czar, actually figure out where each patient had the test, call them to try to actually get the results, often verbally on the telephone or through a fax machine, let alone, so there's an enormous delay and burden in even figuring out where the patient had data and had pending or resulted COVID tests, let alone get them in a machine-understandable way that could automate reporting. And so I say all that because a record locator, for example, so when a patient arrives at a particular provider, there ought to be a record locator service that understands where the patient's been and can automatically get standard compliant information immediately into the data system for provider so they can immediately report. That'll reduce the burden on the provider cost-wise and on the lab, testing sites, et cetera. It just multiplies the cost. It'll reduce the delays in actual reporting. So, A, it's a confirmation of Arian's comment about there being a platform. That platform ought to have a record locator so people aren't trying to figure out where patients were tested.
Great, thank you. Oh, go ahead, Carolyn. I'm glad you're back.
No, go ahead. I'm still trying to get connect to go forward. Go ahead, Jen.
Okay, we're having a little bit of technical problems. So Carolyn's getting back with her excellent moderating skills. Next, Les Leonard.
Hi, yes. It seems like we don't really have a technical issue here. What we have is a lack of incentives to align the systems. And that what we should be suggesting or exploring at this point is how can we incentivize the healthcare system to provide ELR messages that are validated and accurate and that contain, you know, the unique identifier for the test and the unique identifier for the facility and, dare I say, a unique identifier for the patient, however that is constructed, that... that without the right incentives, we're not going to get to that program point. So how do we, that's what's really needed here, because we have the technology in place for all of this right now. It's that there's nothing that's really encouraging people to employ.
So Les, can I just push you a little bit on that? Do you have thoughts about what that might be, as or others? Is I'm just asking this because we've heard lack of incentives as kind of an umbrella in multiple places.
How about
places.
A meaningful use like program for public health data contribution for healthcare providers? That could be a positive incentive, or a Medicare penalty program for providers who fail to produce ELR messages that are meet certification standards. That if their EHR can't be certified to meet the standard, then there would be a penalty. So we've seen this as incredibly effective at getting the healthcare system to rally around it, both the incentives followed by penalties. But if you're going to spend a lot of money, that might be the way to spend it.
Okay, great. And others might have some comments on that. Next, let's go to Abby. Abby Sears?
You might be on mute, Abby.
Yeah, I didn't raise my hand. Sorry.
Oh, okay, I apologize. It's raised in my view. Okay. Next, I see John Kansky's hand raised. John?
Yes, thank you. A bit of a cross-cutting comment. So thinking about the incentives issue and policies we might use to address some of these problems, and thinking about some of the problems that I've identified earlier, I think when we formulate recommendations, we may need to address a big issue, which is, let me try to be a little more articulate. If every state had a statewide health data utility or a health information exchange, that would be an approach that, if these incentives were in place, could lower the burden of implementing them, because in many places they already exist, in some places they don't. But if we set a policy path towards every state having that health data utility, that would be one approach with some gaps to fill. If, on the other hand, we're going to rely on national frameworks or a central federal government approach, with each provider using their electronic health record and standards to report directly to some centralized system, those are completely different approaches. And the reality, as we've seen in our current imperfect but sometimes relatively effective interoperability ecosystem nationally, is that some combination of the two is the best to give providers and states the flexibility to achieve the goals that we want. So I just wanted to acknowledge that we may need to make some recommendation about whether it's one way, another way, or the flexibility to allow different approaches. Thank you.
Thanks, Jen. Clem, I see your hand is raised. Did you have one more brief comment?
Yeah, it's regarding the point-to-point messages. I think a number of people made the point that if you connect each place independently, it's gigantic. It's an exponential kind of workload. And somehow you have to avoid that. And Jen highlighted the two points. And I think, honestly, health information exchanges have been underemphasized as existing opportunities to make this a lot easier. But then you'd like to have the directions, they do go to public health from the health information exchanges in many cases, but allow more other kinds of places to join in if they are held back by regulatory or other barriers. But I think we could make the biggest progress, because there's so many of them are working now, if we can emphasize them more, especially for the public health usages.
Thanks, Clem. It looks like we have no more hands raised. So with that, I think we will continue on with the discussion. I know we do want to at least start taking a look at the crosswalk today. So why don't I hand the mic back to Janet?
Okay, great. Thanks, Carolyn. So let's go on to the next slide. And this is the last slide, and then we can look at the crosswalk as well. I will say there have already been a number of these things that have been identified. So thinking more specifically about what factors impact the timeliness of test reporting, how can the timing of reporting be improved? And people may have some thoughts specific to the improvement. What I will say, what we got a lot of feedback on in the homework were the gaps. So again, if maybe folks want to think of suggestions here, but so gaps that were identified were delays in result reporting due to batch reporting, missing demographic data, lack of electronic orders, lack of incentives to adopt standards necessary for data sharing, delays in lab test site onboarding, in part due to code mapping activities and in part due to they were naive in terms of their ability to support HL7 standard messaging, uncertain about who met which testing criteria to report, and then, of course, manual reporting and mailing of records. So again, those are really gaps, but if folks maybe have additional suggestions on improvements of the timing of reporting. And then the other question for maybe some additional reflection is, what are common data quality or completeness issues encountered How do these data quality and completeness issues impact the public health response? And I think maybe for us to focus on more are what are some of the mechanisms for systematically avoiding and addressing these issues? And again, and we've already heard this come out in our conversation, but I will say missing demographic data, missing information on death in county and zip code, comorbidities, testing guidelines, maybe asked on order entry questions, lack of consistency exchanged from the electronic health record to public health, and organizations not consistently seeing the data that they are sending in terms of getting feedback about data quality issues or missing information so that they could independently course correct. So we'll see if we have any comments on these.
Do we have any task force members on the phone who have comments? I know someone won't show up at Connect, and I want to be sure we don't miss you.
Hey, it's Jim. My hand.
Okay, Jim, let's go with you, and then we'll go to Steve Eichner after Jim.
Yeah, I'm on the last bullet. We ran into this quite a bit where we were submitting data, but because we didn't have confirmation of what was received, not just at the public health department, but also for the federal government's grading us, we began to hear that even though we were 100% compliant on all fields, only our hospitals were only reported as being compliant for 7 days out of that month. So when we dug in, what we found was there were rules behind whether the state reported or we did that were incorrect, that were actually negating our complete submissions because the state was reporting in an incomplete way. We had no insight into that. And so I want to really call out the last bullet that when submitted, there ought to be a confirmation of receipt. And then when there's multiple intermediaries, we ought to have insight into whether data is being lost along the way.
Thanks, Jim. Let's go to Steve Eichner. Steve, you might be muted.
Sorry about that. I think part of the issue is having standards that support the data that we're interested in and being able to communicate those standards in an efficient and timely manner. That certainly presented some issues with COVID-19 with the necessary data elements being created on the fly, and even some problems in terms of getting the data incorporated into HL7 messages. I think some of that is, look, we can also improve the routing of reporting to take better advantage of health information exchanges and other resources to include some of the non-medical information, some of the demographic fields can get populated perhaps in other ways. I think what happens if we push some of the reviews for data quality further to the provider in terms of leveraging things like RCKMS to do a quality check to ensure at least data completeness at the provider level rather than it getting to public health and a response for additional information because there's a missing field, take 2 or 3 days to get back. So the provider, can't we alter how we're doing it to do some of those basic error checks at the provider end without creating an additional burden on the provider, but make it easier for more complete information to be reported? Thank you.
Thanks, Steve. Let's go to Abby Sears. Abby Sears.
Yeah, thank you. I think my comments are in here, but I kind of want to pull them out and tease them out a little bit just to make sure that they're clear. What we had issues were, again, were the matching algorithms. We need stronger matching algorithms. I don't have an answer to how, but if we can't match the data, it errors out and it doesn't move at all. And our error rates were upwards of 30%.
So, and that is almost all not, it's almost all naming nomenclatures of culturally different demographics. So the second issue that we had was, even when our data did move, the states were requiring a manual data entry and did not have the abilities to pull down that data into their systems. And so once we're doing manual entry again in some states, even though the data has moved, then there are challenges with data integrity and data quality in that environment. I think that's in here under manual reporting, but I just wanted to call it out to make sure that that we're finding ways to resolve those issues. And I know that part of that is the funding mechanisms and making sure that our infrastructure and our public health environments are modernized. But when they are modernized, we have to stop with the requirements of manual entry as well, because they don't feel comfortable with what they're getting from the national frameworks. That we've got to incentivize the use of the most efficient ways to deliver that data.
Thanks. And let's go to Stephen Henriches.
Thank you. I want to, in regards to the timing of reporting for improvement and also the issue of mechanisms for avoiding the problems we've outlined, I want to say again, and others have mentioned this, that there are technical solutions that are available and they do work. And particularly I want to cite the example in the latest outbreak where APHL helped in the development of algorithms for automatically identifying case reports and calling out both Cerner and Epic for willingness to participate and implement those algorithms. And they had major impact and were very successful. Thank you.
Thanks, Stephen. And I see Clem McDonald's hand up. Go ahead, Clem.
With regards to matching, and the two speakers saying there was having trouble with matching, and I assumed that was patient matching, but then she wanted to talk about the racial code. So I think clarity on what's being matched is important. I think the last speaker was talking about matching patients. Could I get clarification on that, that the Cerner and the Epic algorithm were actually patient matching algorithms?
I think that was the individual before when I think they were talking about patient matching algorithms. I was talking about case identification algorithms.
But doesn't that depend on patient matching?
It depends what you mean by that.
Well, I think we ought to get clear on what we're all meaning about all this stuff. But if you get a case comes in one case it was John Brown, and you match the case because it's at the same place and the same time, but the other case is was Mary White, that does, you know, it's got, so I'm assuming you got to get the patient first, but please help me with that.
So it looks like this is a point that we need to, Janet and I can frame questions that go out with the homework. Hopefully we'll get some feedback that'll help us crystallize this a little bit more. I know that we did want to get to the crosswalk today at least a bit, and we have our public comment coming up in about 10 minutes. So I think we'll hold on this discussion and see if we can have a more focused, clearer question to address in a future discussion.
Okay.
Why don't we bring up the crosswalk on the screen, and I'll give you a bit of an orientation to this piece. What we have been accumulating through our last couple weeks with the homework is some, and also these discussions, is some feedback about where we sit with some of these questions that ONC has asked us to debate, discuss in our meetings. We now need to coalesce all of that information into some recommendations that this task force can agree upon so that Janet and I can present those at the fall HITECH meeting preliminarily in June, and then to get a vote on the final recommendations at the July HITECH meeting. So we need to keep moving quickly. The crosswalk is a tool that we have used previously in other high-tech work to kind of bring in line all the bits and pieces of information that we're contributing to try to add those up into more specific recommendations that we can make for the national coordinator. The way we organize that, as you can see on the slide now, is, with this crosswalk, is to identify the topics in the left column, to briefly state the gaps, what are the problems or the specific issues that are being addressed or that we need to think about in this topic, any opportunities that we're aware of, that can be tools that some of you have mentioned, or ideas about other actions that can be taken that will support getting to a resolution for the topic, and then some recommendation that we can make based upon what we understand about the gap and any potential opportunities that we've identified. So in coming weeks, as we review this information, Janet and I will be working to kind of align your comments and your homework into these recommendations, and then we'll be looking to refine these. We will also be sending out links to the Google Docs where we ask you to go in and make edits or comments and kind of help us to firm these up and get them to places where the task force can vote and feel comfortable that it really is our broad recommendation rather than something that just one or two of us feel strongly about. So it's a distillation process. Today we wanted to orient you to this document because clearly, being that we have just an hour and a half a week to talk, we probably won't be able to discuss all of the recommendations and all of the questions to the detail that some of us might like to do, you know, in ways that we would proceed with other organizations. Our deadline in July is really a hard deadline in that ONC needs to feed this back to HHS for its deliberations. So we're continuously thinking about how to bring your good perspective into something we can take forward to the national coordinator. Do you want to review any of the specific points in these pages, Janet, or how would you like to go forward getting us started on these?
Thanks, Carolyn. I just wonder, so as you all can see, we have six pages of the crosswalk, so we have been working to coalesce the different information, and we have been dividing them up by the topic area, the gap, the opportunity, and the recommendation. I think one thing, and it's usually true that this happens, is that it's easier to identify, I think, the gap and a little harder to really come up with the recommendation. And so want to encourage people to really focus as we look at this going forward on not just stating the problems, but really trying to be thoughtful about potential recommendations. So maybe it's worthwhile to just walk through what we have already seen in terms of topic areas, and then I can see a number of hands raised for thoughts as well. So as you can see, we've started grouping the different topic areas. So we have syndromic surveillance, electronic laboratory reporting, improved funding, formation of a standing public health work group, major gaps in standards adoptions for key use cases. And if we scroll to the next page, here we see technology and infrastructure factors affecting key surveillance use cases again. Okay. Here you will see, in terms of topic areas, the patient privacy, digital access. Thanks for making that a little bit bigger. Social justice factors affecting key surveillance use cases, policy licensing and legal factors, federal, state, local factors, health equity. Onto the next page, enhancing data sharing between public health and social services. So this is really breaking up the different questions that we have posed over time, streamlining data from large hospitals and provider networks, long-term post-acute care, engaging community providers. And then we have the other topic areas, which we haven't really gotten to for fleshing out. So I think in the interest of time, let me just stop here because I see we have a number of hands raised and some thoughts about this. So let's start. We haven't heard from Jim Daniel at all, so let's start with Jim.
Hi, Janet. Thanks. Can you hear me okay?
We can.
Awesome. So yeah, I was looking at this and I was thinking a lot about what's going to make sense for the people who get the recommendations, right? And I really like the way that you framed today's discussion around, you know, a specific topic, like let's talk about ELR and the details. And I think because these systems are so unique, that recommendations, I think, should be by system as well. So if we think about the core public systems, ELR, immunization, syndromic, electronic case reporting, there are some core recommendations that we can make in each of those areas, and we could kind of follow a template for each one. And I'm just going to kind of go over super high level what I think those things would be. And I think number one, and this is something that we haven't done, and I think it's really important because it's part of the executive order, we need to describe, based on what we've learned from COVID, what we knew from Ebola and Zika, what's the ideal business case? What should be happening? Completely from the business perspective, let's forget about standards, the technology. Let's describe the data flow and what should be happening for each of these systems. And I think we should be doing that from the perspective of the jurisdictional health department, the provider, the payer, and other stakeholders. I mean, payers, laboratories, you know, it'll depend on, you know, which system we're talking about, which stakeholders, other stakeholders might be important. But I think we need to describe that ideal, forgetting about the standards, number one. Then, and that's something I don't think we've done, then we can start, I think, putting in some of the other stuff that we've documented already into a template that talks about, you know, what are the current technical barriers? What are the current policy technical barriers? And then how do we get to that ideal? You know, what are the standards? What does the EHR have to do? What does the public health receiver have to do? And then what are the incentives to do this? And I think that kind of framework gets us to a better sense where it's clear to the federal government, you know, what are the kinds of things that they can do to change to actually make this happen. And we've also got that clear business case of how things should be flowing. And I think it's clear in all of our minds, and, you know, everything we're talking about is assuming that ideal data flow, but we've got to describe that. So I think it's clear to everyone and that we all agree on what that is.
Thanks, Jim. Let's go to Erin Murray.
Thank you. All right. So I want to take a step up a little bit. I think we're all focused on, I think we're all talking about the same things here, and I completely agree. There's a need of adoption of systems and funding and standards and so forth and so on. But let's go back to last year, what happened, right? As this rolled out, as we started determining what tests, what lab tests could actually be used, you know, whether, you know, it was a PCR test, whether it was a rapid test, whether it was an antigen test and all these different things, and now they have the home kits. A lot of these results did not interface at all with, or they weren't built. It wasn't there wasn't a you know, corresponding LOINC code for it. There wasn't a SNOMED code for it, right? There wasn't these elements that were there fast enough. And so at the end of the day, as here in Austin, when we were doing contact tracing, obviously test results matter because hours and days mean exposure. And so we ended up setting up two CLIA certified labs just to process up to 5,000 each lab results a day, just to get in front of the demand because the private labs got overwhelmed. But the problem was we couldn't move fast enough in updating our systems to process the types of labs that we were starting to push through the system. So perhaps there could be an item on this crosswalk about future acceleration of lab results. And maybe there's a way under a public health declaration or whatever that there is something of the equivalent of SNOMED or something to that effect that CCHIT systems can adopt and will be forced to adopt. Maybe there's a carrot for that. And so to the degree of it, I say this in terms of, from a lab perspective, accelerating the result was only half the battle, right? The other half of the battle was associating it to the note. And half of the battle there was standards, lack of standards, and then sharing that information across a community. So I would recommend that there is one more item on this crosswalk about accelerating the future. And that definitely comes down to speed of result and speed of that information to clinicians' hand.
Thanks, Aaron. I see we have two hands up and we have 2 minutes to go to public comment. So I will ask Les, please, to give us a brief comment.
I think that as what was said in the chat box, we need to look specifically at how TEFCA can alleviate many of these problems and to task ONC with looking at its existing framework and then applying it to these problems.
Thanks, Les. And in the last minute, Clem, one last brief comment, please.
So home testing and these testings aren't done by labs is a big problem with COVID. We should focus on that. And I think we should be doing studies and not just deciding out of our own insights. Similarly with the registration data, that's a big overarching problem. It's just not moving right. And I think we should study it. We should commit, you know, get funding to analyze what's really going on, because that should be solvable fairly easily. And it covers lots and lots of things. The third one is the fact public health and healthcare operate very independently, almost with great joy, they'd say separate. I think they got to be better merged. You know, public health decided to make one style of dealing with the specimen, and generally clinical healthcare made another, and those create problems. But anyway, we should focus on some general problem areas and get some study money to figure out what really is going on and how to do it better.
Thanks, Clem. And with that, we will be moving to public comment.
All right. Thank you, everybody. I appreciate all the good discussion. And I would like to ask the operator to open up the line for public comments.
Yes, thank you. If you would like to make a comment, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. A confirmation tone will indicate your line is in the queue. You may press star 2 if you would like to remove your line from the queue. And for participants using speaker equipment, it may be necessary to pick up the handset before pressing the star keys. We will pause for just a brief moment. There are no comments at this time.
Okay, and I just want to remind the public, if you're having any issues with making a public comment, remember to hit star 1, as the operator mentioned, after you dial that number on the screen. Otherwise, you could always put something in the chat to us, and we will make sure that we get to your comment. And I'll turn it back over to Janet and Carolyn. Thank you.
So I see a couple of hands from our task force members have come up. I will ask Stephen Lane, please, to go ahead with a very brief comment before we circle back and check on the public comment one more time.
Thanks. Just very briefly, I just wanted to encourage the task force co-chairs to take the time to review the public chat. A lot's going on there today, and I know that as a co-chair, sometimes it's not possible to monitor that during the course of a meeting. So I just encourage you to take the time.
Thanks, Steve. That's an excellent point. We will definitely be taking a look at those logs, and they will be added to the transcript of the meetings that we hope will be appearing on the ONC website soon. Let's circle back and check one more for public comments, please.
There is no one queued in for comment.
then I think we will go back to Brett and Brenda for our next steps and what to expect in the next week.
Sure. Thank you, Carolyn, and thanks everyone for a great discussion today. So we have our meeting again next week, same time, and we will be finishing up some of the conversation we had today. It sounds like there will be some additional questions that we want to dig a little bit deeper into in terms of homework. And if we can move forward a couple more slides to the next steps one. So we will get out links to SurveyMonkey where all of the great information that we saw on the slides and some of the recommendations were pulled from. We will get those out by Friday. And just as a reminder, we will be sharing the responses to those questions with the task force members as well as the public as part of the materials. So if you haven't had a chance to go in and want to provide comments on some of the items that we are still discussing, please go ahead and do that. And then we will get things turned around for the next meeting. If you can get those to us by 10 a.m. on June 1st, 10 a.m. Eastern, that is.
And just to clarify for all the task force members, starting next week, we will be sending out the feedback to you because we are accumulating enough that we think it will be valuable for you as you review the recommendations and think about that to have everything handy and also as you're prepped for these meetings on Thursdays. So please be looking for that. And if you have some other feedback you haven't added to the spreadsheets yet, please do plan to update those in the next few days so that's available for us.
And just another point that I'd add there, Carolyn. So the recommendations crosswalk that we were looking at on the later part of the call today, we do have plans to get that into a Google Doc to allow task force members to provide comments using the Google Docs comments function and, you know, make iterations to those as we continue to discuss them and narrow those down.
Mike, did you have anything else to add, other announcements or considerations either for the task force or for the public?
The only thing I'll mention is that we are reconvening next Thursday at 10:30 Eastern Time, and other than that, I don't have any other updates, so thank you.
What? Any last closing thoughts, Janet, or other business we need to wrap up?
Thanks, Carolyn. I just really appreciate everybody's really robust discussion, and I think we all recognize that this is complex, and we are very grateful for all of your dedication and time and thoughts. So thank you all.
Okay. Thank you, everyone, for joining us today. We really appreciate it. And with that, I will adjourn today's meeting, and we'll see you next week. Thank you. Have a great day.